On this episode of The Big Number, we dive into the stats to answer these questions. Who's a lock for the 2026 Hall of Fame class? Can one big number make Andre Iguodala a shoe-in? And did the Bulls make the right move, paying Josh Giddey? All this coming up right now. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome to The Big Number. I'm Tom Haberstroh. We do this every week here on Yahoo Sports. That's my man and your man, Dan Devine. Dan, I've got a little announcement here at the top of the show.
Okay.
Everybody needs to check us out on Yahoo Sports Network, our brand new streaming TV channel. That's right. Yahoo Sports Network. It's available to stream on any leading fast services. It's also streaming live 24/7 on yahoosports.tv, not .com. That's old news. We're now .tv, yahoosports.tv, where you can catch all the shows on your phone or your browser on your TV. Big fan of this new Yahoo Sports Network and the fact that our lovely mugs are going to be on your TV, with beards included.
That's exactly right. I've been told so many times that I had a face for podcasting, and it turns out that was just an end run to get me on TV. Try to keep me away from it, various teachers. That was rude of you to say those things about my face when I was a younger person. But Tom, now that we've established that Yahoo Sports Network is up and running and that we're going to be part of it, I got this feeling like I need to put some numbers on the board. What is our big number for this week?
Dan, this week's big number is 96.3%. That's
a big number.
Of eligible Hall of Fame players in the NBA who have won a Finals MVP. Ooh. And they have actually been inducted into the Hall of Fame. So 96% of the people that win Finals MVP are in the Naismith Hall of Fame, which means, I'm going to say it, Andre Iguodala, step on up, ooh, get your orange jacket on. I am predicting that next year, you are going to be inducted into the Hall of Fame. Actually, you know what? I'll say at any point, maybe not calling my shot that next year will happen, but Andre Iguodala, I think, should be in the the Naismith Hall of Fame. I've written an article about this. I'm a big believer in Andre Iguodala's Hall of Fame credentials. And we just saw Dwight Howard and Carmelo Anthony get enshrined in immortality at Naismith Hall of Fame. Congratulations to them and to all of the ones who got inducted into the Hall of Fame this past weekend. And we're looking ahead to maybe the next year's class and the year after that. Who are we most excited or most interesting cases to be in the Hall of Fame? And Dan, I feel like Andre Iguodala has a very underrated case. I feel like most people wouldn't put him in the first ballot. But when we're talking about not just your NBA credentials, but also your international credentials, I feel like Andre Iguodala, with two gold medals, 2010 FIBA gold medal, along with Kevin Durant. You also have the 2012 Olympics gold medal, which Coach K said he was one of the best players on the team. He wasn't getting no participation medal here. He's one of the best contributors on that squad. And then you throw in the four titles, the All-Star appearance, the Finals MVP, like at the top, the only player who has won Finals MVP that has not been inducted into the NBA Hall of Fame is Cedric Maxwell with the 81 Celtics team. But he wasn't an All-Star like Iguodala. He doesn't have four rings like Andre Iguodala. He wasn't a two-time gold medalist with Team USA like Andre Iguodala. He wasn't two-time all-defensive team like Andre Iguodala. So, Dan, I feel like, yes, he doesn't have the most traditional case, but I think he is the no-stats Hall of Famer, meaning the box score stats do not do him service. They do not capture the brilliance of Andre Iguodala. And if you look at the advanced stats, the modern stats, the on-court, off-court, the advanced, regularized, adjusted plus-minus numbers, all of that stuff point to Andre Iguodala as being a top 10, top 5 player at his peak and top 20 for years and years and years. Basically, he should have been an all-star all these years or all-NBA, and he only had one all-star to his resume. But Dan, as someone who's covered the league and has seen Andre Iguodala up close winning these titles, what do you think about his candidacy? What do you think about his chances?
I think the line of distinction you made where it's not just the NBA Hall of Fame, it is the Basketball Hall of Fame, is a huge part of it. Because, yeah, once you start folding in multiple gold medals at the Olympics, like, that's a huge part of it. And also, as you noted, it wasn't like he was an also-ran. He was a significant part of the of those teams that won titles, won gold medals, rather. What's interesting to me as you go through, like, when I was, and this is my own fault, when I was like looking at his, you know, basketball reference page, looking at his resume this morning before we got on, I just assumed there would be at least one sixth man of the year there, like, for the work that he did with the Warriors and how critical he was for those Warriors teams. And I think the fact that there isn't goes, is like a point in the direction of our inability to always properly evaluate what a great play, what players bring to the table. So, like, Iguodala's defensive work, Iguodala's ability as a connective passer, even if he's not the one that gets the assist, somebody who reads and maps the floor and can be a quiet contributor on a possession, like the sacrifice cut that opens up somebody else. He was a, like, sort of quieter parts of the game star for years on those Warriors teams. And then before that, I mean, he was like an investor that saw blue chip stock when he was on that Nuggets team that lost to the Warriors. And he's like, okay, I'm about to be a free agent. I'm going to go over there. That Curry guy, pretty good. I think I want to be part of that. But when pressed into duty as a number one kind of guy, like, it was always an ill-fitting suit for him in Philadelphia, but he could score 20 a game and could be an all-star, you know, number one option. So somebody who had all these different sorts of careers within one career and performed at an elite level in those roles, all across the line, I think that is worth evaluating as, like, star level impact, even if the star level stats aren't necessarily there. And then you add into it, like, those Warriors teams, maybe they do win four titles without him being part of the program. I think the people in Golden State would tell you otherwise, mm-hmm. though. And mm-hmm. If you are that, I mean, we've seen it with the Celtics teams over the years. We saw it with, you know, Michael Cooper getting in for his contributions on those Lakers teams. Never an all-star, I believe, Michael Cooper, but they're, like, top level defensive player. There's a place in the room of the Hall of Fame for the players that, like, elevated and made those championship teams and got them to the next spot. I think Andre Iguodala certainly was one of those for, like, the defining team or one of the defining teams of an era of basketball. Yeah, I think that argument for enshrinement is pretty solid.
You mentioned the Warriors people, what they would say about how much impact he had on those four title teams with the Warriors. My favorite stat of Andre regarding Andre Iguodala is that on those finals teams, they made five straight finals with Andre Iguodala on the squad, 2015, 2016, 2017, 2018, 2019. Over those five NBA finals runs, he had a better plus minus than Klay Thompson, who is at plus 53. Okay. In those five finals runs, he had a better plus minus than Draymond Green, who is at plus 119. He was better than Kevin Durant, even though Kevin Durant wasn't on the front end of that run. He had a better plus minus than Kevin Durant on those teams. He even, Andre Iguodala, had a better plus minus in the NBA Finals than Stephen Curry himself. Okay.
Wow.
So if you look at the numbers, Andre Iguodala at plus 148 during that five finals runs with the Warriors was the best on the Golden State team. The best. He had the best plus minus during the NBA Finals when you need to be the biggest impact possible in the biggest moments. Andre Iguodala was there. And I think that's a big reason why he won Finals MVP in that season in 2015, because he was moved into the starting lineup. Steve Kerr was like, we need our best perimeter defender on LeBron. And everything changed from there. And I know it's been debated ad nauseum of whether it should have been LeBron's MVP or Steph's MVP or Andre Iguodala. The fact of the matter is, time and time again, we see not just coaches say this dude is one of the best players in the NBA. Hence, he was on these gold medal teams. But also, the plus minus data is reflecting an elite player that is in, like, the top one percentile in the NBA. And I think if Andre Iguodala was playing today, like if he was in his peak in 2025 rather than in 2015 or even earlier, I think the on-court, off-court numbers, the plus-minus numbers would be so in vogue and we'd be able to speak fluently about the brilliance of Andre Iguodala that he'd be an all-star, that he'd be all defensive teams and much higher in, like, the defensive player of the year vote than he was a couple decades ago. So I think that Andre Iguodala was kind of before his time, because a lot of the contributions that he has, low turnover guy, great passer, he doesn't have a weakness in his game, but more importantly, his defensive locking down the opposing best scorer is valued in today's metrics in ways that it wasn't or non-quantifiable 20 years ago. So Michael Cooper's in, just about every finals MVP is in, and I think Andre Iguodala should be in the Naismith Hall of Fame. And right now, the Basketball Reference Hall of Fame probability odds, which only looks at your NBA credentials, it does not calculate, it doesn't put it into the little stew, your college contributions, your college stats, your accolades in college, or your international accolades. But just looking at his NBA career, he's only 12.7% chance based on prior inductees into the NBA Hall of Fame, based on the stats in the NBA of those who are already in the Hall of Fame as a player. And so Andre Iguodala is much lower on the list than, say, Sean Marion, who's 75% odds, LaMarcus Aldridge at 50%, Blake Griffin 55%, Rajon Rondo at 60%. So based on just those traditional categories in the NBA, it doesn't look like he has a great chance, but you throw in the international and the plus-minus data that is like Mount Rushmore elite at his time, I feel like Andre Iguodala will get in as a Naismith Hall of Famer, and I want him to get sized up right now.
I think it makes a ton of sense. I think the one of my sort of pet things about the Hall of Fame, I know there are a lot of people who make arguments that it should be more restrictive. It should be more based solely on NBA production rather than at the international game. And it should be not like a Hall of Very Good, but only for the truly elite players. And I understand that. I tend to think like it should be it's a museum that tells stories. If you want to learn about the history of the game and you want to have a better sense of what went on and who mattered and why and when, this is the place you should be able to go to get that information. The Warriors aren't the Warriors if the death lineup doesn't happen, right? And obviously your fulcrum there is Draymond Green being able to go and play the five, for sure. But it only works if you have somebody else that can go in on the wing and be that size up, size down, guard, whoever. And so Iguodala unlocked the optionality, the availability of what became the defining lineup of the, you know, a handful of years of NBA basketball, like the fastball that nobody could hit that led to NBA championships. And you mix that with I think the idea of this museum that tells the story of the game, also reflecting our advancing understanding of what contributes to winning and losing on the floor and who matters, maybe matters more than a traditional box score understanding of statistics would have, would lead you to believe. And so to me, like Iguodala as an avatar of that, it's not to me the same as saying, well, we should put Shane Battier in because Shane Battier was like the, you know, nominal no stats all-star from the profile that Michael Lewis wrote, but Iguodala was like a star player whose true value was hidden and then came to be revealed later. So to me, I think the contribution to winning on both on like club and country and the what he sort of represents for our advancing understanding of value on the basketball court, I think there's space in the hall for him. And yeah, I tend to agree with you. It might not be as soon as he becomes available, eligible. You know, I believe next year is when his first year of eligibility. But if not then probably pretty soon thereafter, because I think we're seeing the hall is expanding to give us more opportunities to recognize players who make the contributions that he did.
Yeah. Steve Kerr said he is one of the great amplifiers in NBA history.
That's a great term for it.
Amplify makes everybody better, amplifies everything that your star players, that your role players are doing out on the floor. And it's not always picked up in the box score, except in the plus minus data where he is, again, elite. I will also say that, you know, the international, just to reiterate, he has more gold medals than anyone who's eligible next year, basically. He's got more gold medals than Rondo, Blake Griffin, John Wall, LaMarcus Aldridge, Sean Marion. All of them combined don't have as many gold medals as Andre Iguodala. And that's not everything, but as we've seen with Dino Raja being inducted into the Hall of Fame, it's like that stuff does matter, is how you do international play. So shouts to Andre Iguodala, who also was leading the players union and all that. So there's plenty of stuff that Andre Iguodala that has that isn't just, you know, on the court impact in the league. So also he gave LeBron James his signature moment in the finals, with the block. So I guess in terms of the storytelling, Dan can't really tell the story of the NBA and the NBA finals without Andre Iguodala getting blocked. But also he was doing a lot of the blocking and not just getting blocked.
The good stuff too. But yeah, listen, it's all part of the story. So let's celebrate all of it.
J.R. Smith, Hall of Famer, part of the story.
You know I'm down for that. I'm super into that. I want to be there for that induction speech though.
All right, Dave, we've got four other candidates who could be immortalized next summer or down the line. You know what? I'll say it right here. I'm not really sure the eligibility rules, because I thought on the website it says at least four seasons since you've been retired, and yet Carmelo Anthony and Dwight Howard are in.
Yeah.
With, they've only been gone for three seasons and they're in. So I'm not really sure what the eligibility requirements are. The official website, the official one from Naismith Hall of Fame says at least four. Maybe that's been changed, but considering that it's been 3 years since Carmelo and Dwight have played in the NBA, and it will be three for Andre Iguodala, I feel like next year he will be starting to be eligible. But let's talk about four candidates right after the break who are the most interesting Hall of Fame candidates going forward. All right, so we talked about Andre Iguodala being Hall of Famer worthy going forward. Just a reminder, the Yahoo Sports Network, go check it out, Fast Channel. You'll see our pretty faces on there. Go check out that. And also check out these four little numbers from Dan. What's your first little number, Dan, from the future Naismith Hall of Fame candidates?
First little number this week is 124.9. That's how many win shares Sean Marion amassed across his 16-year NBA career. That's the most of any retired player who's not in the Hall of Fame. It's also more than a lot of guys who are in the Hall of Fame. You want to hear some names?
Yeah, let's hear them.
Carmelo Anthony, Chauncey Billups, Tony Parker, Chris Bosh, Grant Hill, Tracy McGrady, and the list goes on. So Sean Marion. And
Sean Marion, The Matrix.
The Matrix.
He
Hall of Fame nickname.
Also Hall of Fame worthy. You're telling me he has the highest win share total of any eligible player, retired player who's not in the Hall of Fame. That's incredible. I think that is a trivia question that not a lot of people would answer correctly. Who's got that title? And it's Sean Marion. Wow.
Yep. Sean Marion, about five win shares clear of guys like Buck Williams and I think like six or seven clear of Horace Grant. So there's a pretty significant gap there. And Marion, somewhat similar to the kind of player that we were talking about with Andre Iguodala, where the value of him was maybe a little bit hidden by some of the higher wattage stars that he played with, but his ability to do everything at a high level and to play, you know, to play different roles at a super, super high level allowed for some of those stars to flourish. So one of only 12 players in NBA history, 12 players ever with at least 17,000 points, 10,000 rebounds, 2,000 assists, and 1,000 each of steals and blocks. So again, you're talking about fills the stat sheet, does everything. That list is 10 guys who are already in the Hall of Fame: LeBron James and Sean Marion.
Yeah, you know what? It's like you're hitting win shares, which is a very nerdy, Vorpy number, right? But then you have points, rebounds, assists, steals, and blocks. And it's
a little
like,
bit easier to understand those things.
Yeah,
right?
And he's 12 players. He's on a list, an exclusive club with 12 members.
Yep. And again, 10 of those guys, the ones that are already retired and eligible, they're all in the Hall of Fame. Then there's LeBron James, who will obviously walk in the second he walks out of the game. And Sean Marion is the 12th name on that list. So you've got the box score stats, you've got the advanced stats, and then there's the narrative component. Foundational piece in a revolutionary team in the 7 Seconds or Less Suns. And you can argue Steve Nash is the pilot of that, obviously. Mike D'Antoni is the architect of that, no doubt about it. Amari Stoudemire, who we could be talking about in this segment, but we don't have him in there today, also a huge piece of that because of his ability to play the five and like space out and spread and the pick and roll, everything came from there. But if you got Amari Stoudemire and Steve Nash, you need somebody to defend, and you need somebody to be able to defend big guys, small guys, and do all the dirty work around it. Sean Marion unlocked that lineup that kind of revolutionized the NBA. And then in a dramatically different role later in his career, is the defensive cornerstone of the 2011 Mavericks on the wing up ahead of Tyson Chandler. Again, if you've got Dirk and to allow Dirk to cook, Jason Terry to cook, you need somebody to take all of those other defensive assignments. Marion was a huge part of a championship team in a like lower star wattage, but just as important role. Also, four-time All-Star, two-time All-NBA selection. So like he had star accolades, he had star scoring, star performance, and also was a gigantic role player on teams of consequence that you can't tell the story of the NBA without talking about them. So Marion retired in 2015. He's been eligible for a while. He hasn't broken through. I think I've made a pretty compelling case for him being in, but Tom, you be the arbiter here. You tell me, did I get you over the line?
Yeah, I think he's in. I think he gets in. I think also because, Dan, when you're talking about the candidates that he might be coming in with, he needs kind of a down year to kind of rise to the surface. Sure. And I think this is, you know, upcoming class isn't going to be as star-studded as they typically are. And so Sean Marion, quick story, when the Miami Heat won the NBA championship in 2012, when Chris Bosh slid to the five and he was able to play small ball and they spaced the floor, Eric Spoelstra, after winning that title, texted Mike D'Antoni and said, "We did it. We climbed the mountain." And the point was, is that Eric Spoelstra owed Mike D'Antoni and the 7 seconds or less Suns so much credit that he thought he owed all of the flowers to Mike D'Antoni for changing the game and allowing Eric Spoelstra to feel like, okay, I can space the floor with Chris Bosh and have this kind of like spacey high pick and roll, not traditional start two bigs lineup. And a lot of that was because of Sean Marion unlocked all of that. And Sean Marion not only beat so many teams on those 7 seconds or less with two-time Steve Nash and Amar'e Stoudemire, he also beat Eric Spoelstra in the 2011 NBA Finals, right, doing the same sort of stuff. And so if you need someone who values that sort of play from Sean Marion, I guarantee you that Eric Spoelstra, who many believe is the best coach in the NBA, and for my money, he is the best coach in the NBA, I got to imagine he has a lot of positive things to say about Sean Marion. And I would probably imagine he would co-sign him being inducted into the Hall of Fame. So Sean Marion, I think he's in. His NBA stats have him at 76% chance of being in the Hall of Fame. I think he's in. Who's your next candidate?
Second little number this week is 22. That's how many players have scored 20,000 points, grabbed 8,000 rebounds, and made at least 7 All-Star teams over their NBA careers. 20,000 points, 8,000 boards, 7 All-Star appearances. 18 of those players are already in the Hall. 3 of them are still playing. That's LeBron, Giannis, and Russell Westbrook. And number 22 is LaMarcus Aldridge. Aldridge is an interesting case to me because there's a statistical resume for it, as we established those, you know, that really upper tier of scoring, rebounding, and recognition from the, you know, the fans and peers, right? The coaches, whether it's you were voted in as a starter, I don't believe he ever was voted in as a starter, but I believe he was chosen by coaches over the course of his career 7 different times during his time in Portland and then with San Antonio. 5-time All-NBA selection, 2 second team, 3 third team. So like never the best 4 or 5 in the league. You know, we always viewed him as sort of in that conversation, but in that conversation for a decade. Mainstay on perennial playoff teams, 50-ish win teams in Portland. He kind of kept that franchise afloat as it transitioned from, you know, like all the promise of the Brandon Roy, Greg Oden era, but there were all the injuries that sort of submarined that, and then transitioning to the Damian Lillard era. Only won 3 playoff series, so that's a little bit dicey, but he was awesome in the playoffs when the Blazers waved off when Dame, you know, bye-bye'd the Houston Rockets in the first round there. He like tore apart Dwight Howard in that series. And he was a huge part of that awesome Spurs team in 2017. They made it to the Western Conference Finals. They were going head up with the Warriors, the Kevin Durant Warriors. And then, you know, Zaza got his foot in under Kawhi's landing spot and history changes from there. But Aldridge was like the marquee free agent signing that leveled that team up and like bridged them after Tim Duncan. Never the best player at his position, reliably among the best for like a decade. And every eligible player who has scored as many points as he has in his career is in. So, what do you think about LaMarcus Aldridge's case?
He's in my book, but I worry that he's not going to make it. He, LaMarcus Aldridge, is a case that I think from the basketball, like traditional basketball statistics, like I think he's got the case, like you said, at the top. What worries me is he wasn't even nominated this year. He, like, Carmelo was nominated, same retired last season. Dwight Howard was nominated, but LaMarcus Aldridge was not. And that's really confusing to me. What are the credentials or the eligibility criteria that you have to get in? I was surprised that LaMarcus Aldridge was not on the list this year. Doesn't make me super confident that he will get in one day. Also, not the international stuff that you see with Andre Iguodala. So the deep playoff runs, international, Olympics, all that, FIBA, not really some stripes on his sleeve for LaMarcus Aldridge. But in terms of that 2017, Zaza Pachulia is one of the most underrated moments in NBA history, is the Zaza Pachulia foot underneath Kawhi Leonard, because that Spurs team was so freaking good, dude. Like that team, I remember covering that Warriors season and that 2017 season, looking at the point differential and how good the Spurs were. And I was just like, it's unfair that these two teams are in the same conference.
Right.
It's totally unfair that only one of these teams is going to make it to the NBA Finals, when it's clearly these are the two best teams in the NBA. And man, the Spurs were rolling before that. And LaMarcus Aldridge and the story of LaMarcus Aldridge changes on that play. And so LaMarcus Aldridge with the Blazers and with the Spurs, kind of this renaissance under Greg Popovich and Kawhi Leonard, just one of those buckets. Like if Carmelo Anthony is this go-to bucket, I think LaMarcus Aldridge in similar fashion is just a guy that you get the rock to, and he's going to be able to get you buckets. And the rebounding, college doesn't have the credentials, I don't think, to kind of put him over the top and make a no doubt case. But at 50% by his NBA bona fides, I feel like LaMarcus Aldridge, he's going to be a borderline case. I think I would put him in, but I can see why he might not get in one day, Dan.
Yeah, the lack of sort of like flashbulb moments in your mind, I think, is right. Like, you know, it's not that the University of Texas teams when he was there, it wasn't like they, you know, made it all the way. Like Carmelo has the national championship in Syracuse, right? You know, you don't have that with LaMarcus Aldridge. You only have one series where he made it to the Western Conference Finals, and nobody remembers that, you know, that Spurs team because of what we just talked about and the Warriors continuing to advance on. So yeah, I think it makes sense. And then when you think about his greatest successes in Portland, you think more about Dame, or you think more about Brandon Roy than you do about Aldridge. So he has that kind of, it's the quieter list of accolades that's going to maybe fade from memory a little bit more. So I hear what you're saying. I think there is a case to be made, but 50% on the Hall of Fame probability sounds about right. Coin flip kind of case, I think. Moves us to our third little number here. So LaMarcus Aldridge's career scoring mark, 19.1 points per game. That's how much he averaged. Our third little number is 20.1. That's the career scoring average of Marcus Johnson, not LaMarcus, Marcus Johnson. If you're an NBA fan today, you probably know Marcus best as the longtime color commentator on the Milwaukee Bucks local broadcast. He's awesome at that job. If you are a cinephile, you might know him best as Raymond in White Men Can't Jump. The guy who responds to getting hustled by Wesley Snipes and Woody Harrelson by saying he's going to go back to his car, get his gun, and come back and shoot everybody. Great comedy performance from Marcus Johnson in that movie. But before those things, college legend at UCLA, National Player of the Year in 1977, won a national championship in 1975 at UCLA, number retired by the Bruins, like bona fide college star, number three pick in the NBA draft, five All-Star teams, three All-NBA teams, including a first team nod. So there was a year where he was viewed as one of the two best forwards in the NBA. Spent the early portion of his career pretty much like vying with Dr. J and Larry Bird for the title of the best forward in the game. Then some drug problems, serious neck injury cut his career short in the late 80s. So he doesn't have the gaudy compiled stats. But for his career, 20.1 points per game, better than 50% shooting from the field. Only 19 retired players have averaged 20 a game for their career on 50% shooting or better. 18 of them are in the Hall of Fame already. And then there is Marcus Johnson. He's been a finalist several times in recent years, but hasn't broken through, probably because of his shortened career. Only like 691 games, only 9 full seasons. But given the peak, given the college resume and given, as you mentioned, maybe not the strongest superstar wattage case around him. Like, this isn't a year where it's going to be Kobe and KG and Tim Duncan. Maybe that gives him an opportunity for a longer look. What do you think?
Yeah, the guy's already in the College Hall of Fame. And then, by the way, he was one of the best players in the NBA. So it's not like a Christian Laettner, like, yeah, he was great in college, but like, can you really make a case in the NBA? Dude was one of the best players in the league for a very long time. And so you throw in the fact 5-time All-Star, 3-time All-NBA, and was a stud at college and delivered the last championship for UCLA under John Wooden. I feel like Marcus Johnson's in, man. Dan, I think I'm glad you brought him up, because I feel like if he doesn't get in now, I worry that his time is running out. So this is going to be the year, 2026.
And I think if you are a younger fan who is not familiar, do some Googling on this. Go check out some of the, you know, hit your YouTubes and see where what you can find there, because he's an like those Bucks teams in the late 70s, early 80s, they wound up falling short to the Sixers and Doc and Moses Malone, or to Bird Celtics. This is Don Nelson in Milwaukee. So it's before the We Believe Warriors. It's before his time in Dallas, all that. But he's like, Paul Pressey, you are going to be a point forward. Marcus Johnson, you're going to guard the five sometimes. You know, like, we're going to do our Nelly's Laboratory stuff. But before, you know, years and years before it finally breaks through, he was sliding among different responsibilities. He was a power wing scorer, rebounder, but also a ball handler and a creator who could slide up and guard fives. Like, there was a lot of the future in Marcus Johnson. And, you know, it gets lost to history a little bit because of the competition he played in, because his career didn't last as long as it could have. But that argument of a Hall of Fame peak, could that be enough to get you over the line? It also brings us to our fourth and final little number this week. It's the biggest number I've said so far. 14,513. It's a pretty big number. That's how many points Blake Griffin scored in his NBA career, which lasted 13 seasons. 14,513. Fewer than Allen Houston, Jason Richardson, Mike Bibby, Monte Ellis, Richard Jefferson. Stop me when we get to a no doubt about it Hall of Famer. Griffin didn't.
Fewer points than Mike Bibby? Oh,
fewer
man.
Points than Mike Bibby. I mean, and I could hear our pal J.E. Skeets spitting off to the side at the mention of Mike Bibby's name. But Blake never won a championship. Never made it out of the second round with the Clippers. Only got out of there as a member of the Celtics in his final year, where he was like a bit part player, end of the bench guy on that Boston team. However, think about peak Blake Griffin, right? And you're talking about 6 All-Star teams, 5 All-NBA selections, National Player of the Year at Oklahoma. The guy who really started the, you know, resurrection of the Clippers before Chris Paul, the Chris Paul trade then makes them a bona fide championship contender for the rest of the decade, basically. And to my point earlier about, like, it's a museum about the story of the game, like, there's got to be a place for somebody who was at his peak, the most electrifying, most watchable, basically made the NBA's YouTube channel something that you would subscribe to for the highlights, the Mozgoving, the what he did to Pau Gasol, the dunk highlight reels, one of the great highlight reels of all time. You can't tell the story of the 2010s NBA without Blake Griffin. And I kind of feel like that's a player that belongs in Springfield. Am I crazy to think that?
I think it's the single greatest rookie season, like the last great rookie season. Like, Wemby was cool. We've had some good rookie seasons. Ja Morant comes to mind, just like electrifying player. Nothing holds a candle recently to Blake Griffin in Lob City and what they were doing. It was insane what Blake Griffin was doing. And you throw in the fact that he was the National College Player of the Year at Oklahoma. This isn't just about, hey, he dunked a lot. He's way more skilled than just being a dunker. I think later in his career, I think he got enough people watching to realize, oh, he's not just a dunker. He's a really skilled player that can not just be able to get you buckets on the block, but run your offense, you know, and distribute the rock and be able to set up teammates. He's a wonderful passer, underrated passer. And I feel like when you look at his career, the numbers, the impact on resurrecting the Clippers and Lob City, There is one I remember on Twitter. Like, he was, when NBA Twitter was popping, a lot of it was due to Blake Griffin. Like, the valuation on Twitter and how much money they've raised, how much money Twitter has made, I think a lot of that could be attributed to Blake Griffin, because he was taking off at right around the time that NBA Twitter was taking off. I remember there was one tweet where I was coming up and I was like, there was a screen grab of Blake Griffin finishing an alley-oop from Chris Paul, where Blake Griffin was before half court when the alley-oop was thrown. And he dunked an alley-oop where he was at half court when the alley-oop was thrown. Like, I tweeted that out, so a photo sick of it, right when, like, I guess it was right when Twitter started putting out, adding photos to tweets. By the way, this is we are dating ourselves. Right,
I know,
here,
the gray in our beard is getting grayer by the word.
Yeah, go YouTube it. That was Blake Griffin, was doing stuff we had never seen before from a guy that size. The thing we wanted Zion Williamson to be was Blake Griffin.
Yeah. Yeah. And no, it's a great point.
Just from a electrifying standpoint, from a statistical standpoint, his college resume. I think he's a great ambassador for the game, a really funny dude. And I'm really excited to see him on the airwaves this year. So I think Blake Griffin, I think he's in. I think Blake Griffin is in. And I don't know if he's going to be first ballot Hall of Famer, but I think he's got a really strong case before all the injuries kind of sapped the tail end of his career. But I love Blake Griffin. Watching him play basketball was a joy and brought so much joy to the fans. And also, I think his game was much better than what I think people gave him credit for early in his career.
Yeah, the evolution where, I mean, there was a point where, and I forget when I wrote this, but at some point where, like, as his ball handling and his creation and the larger role that he took on in the Clippers offense, I'm like, that's the closest thing to LeBron James there is outside of LeBron James right now, where you have, like, a guy that size, that strength, that scoring touch, but also the ability to facilitate. And then he goes through the injuries, he goes through the up and down period at the end of the time with the Clippers, he gets dealt to Detroit, and he was still an all-NBA player in, like, a diminished and altered state in Detroit. Like, there, one of the, your point about his underrated skill set, I think is exactly right. Somebody who, even when he couldn't jump out of the gym anymore, was still impacting the game at an elite level. I think that was, you know, there it would be enough to me just what he was in that first iteration, but the fact that there was more and that he got more out of it even down the line, I think it goes a long way toward that. And really what I want to think about most is when he dunked on Timofey Mozgov, when Timofey Mozgov was the Knicks center, Amari Stoudemire was on the court then. And this is, again, post-injuries Amari, right? So Amari, like, Blake kind of traced the career arc. He was that electric, explosive, gigantic dunker early in his career. And then after some knee injuries, had to move out to the perimeter. Amari was moving out to the perimeter at that point. Amari gets fouled, goes to the free throw line right after the Mozgov dunk. And he just looks at Blake Griffin and kind of, like, raises his eyebrows, like, all right, like, I can't say anything because that guy's my teammate. But, like, like, I'm familiar with what that is like, oh, my God. And there was a moment that I'm never going to forget, just tomorrow, like, real recognizing real in the moment. And, like, everybody trying to not laugh as it's happening. Blake Griffin has delivered plenty of laughs over his time. That was maybe one of my favorite first ones. Let's put that in the hall.
Speaking of which, the ad that he did, the comedy skit he did with Chris Paul for Jordan Brand when he was with the Clippers,
yeah,
is one of the funniest things I've watched, sports or not. It's one of the great skits. And I just feel like he made a lot of people laugh and feel joy as NBA fans, basketball fans. Of course, I think people in Oklahoma feel the same way. So, man, Steph Curry, Blake Griffin, when they were coming through, it was like, it must see TV every time they stepped on the floor. All right, so that'll do it. Our four little numbers, four candidates, Marcus Johnson, Sean Marion, LaMarcus Aldridge, Blake Griffin, all got great cases. Also a great case is Andre Iguodala, the No Stats Hall of Famer. We're going to talk Josh Giddey and the news that he is re-signing with the Chicago Bulls and what that means for maybe Jonathan Kuminga and Quentin Grimes. We'll talk about the restricted free agents that are finally signing to deals right after the break. Dan, we got some news. Josh Giddey, according to ESPN, Shams Charania has signed a four-year, $100 million contract to remain with the Chicago Bulls. That's big news because we're still waiting on Jonathan Kuminga and the Golden State Warriors, and about six other players are waiting on that news. How many players are under contract with the Warriors? Like, is it like six? Can they field a team? I don't know. But the point is, Josh Giddey is back with the Chicago Bulls. Four years, $100 million, 25 per year. Going back to July 30th, when we did the big number, we looked at Fred Katz's The Athletic article, which was fantastic, where he polled a bunch of GMs and executives around the league to see what predict what the average annual salary would be for the four restricted free agents. We're talking Josh Giddey, Jonathan Kuminga, Cam Thomas, and Quentin Grimes. And the average annual salary for Josh Giddey came down to 22.3, and we both took the over on that. So congratulations, pat ourselves on the back here for correctly saying and predicting that Josh Giddey would get a little bit more than 22.3 million. It is officially $100 million contract over 4 years, 25 million. That seems right to me. It feels like Josh Giddey, the resurrection that he had kind of halfway through the season as the guy who can also shoot. And yes, Alex Caruso went on to win a championship, the one-for-one trade with the Chicago Bulls. But I think Josh Giddey kind of availed himself quite well in Chicago last year. He's basically averaging a triple-double for the second half of the season. And I need to remind people, the dude is still 22 years old.
Right.
He's younger than Dalton Knecht. Right. He's younger than a lot of second year guys, third year guys. He's still like adding to his game and developing. So he's still 22. He's turning 23, I think, like later in the fall. But the point is that to get this guy, this talented player, who he's not going to be MVP, he's not going to be first team All NBA, I don't think. But to get him at a $25 million valuation annually, that's a solid contract for the Chicago Bulls. And we haven't been doling out a lot of compliments to Arturis Kornishovas and the front office there in Chicago. But I think this is pretty good business for the Chicago Bulls. And I think Josh Giddey, he shot much better from downtown. And that was the one weakness in his game. I wouldn't say the only weakness, but one of the sore spots in his game was his ability to stretch the floor and kind of play as a guy that you can't go under on those screens. Hit a really good mark after the All-Star break. And I think Josh Giddey signing for $25 million a year with the Chicago Bulls. I'm still waiting. Jonathan Kuminga, what's going to happen there? But we finally have a deal with him and Cam Thomas, which we'll talk about in a little bit.
Yeah, with Giddey, I mean, it sounds about right, if for no other reason than the reporting going back months was he wanted 30, the Bulls were at around 20, so we go right in the middle at 25. You know, it's like, and if that was the case, maybe we could have done this 2 months ago. Yeah. I don't know, but like, you know, maybe whatever. It's not for me to, you know, the hardline negotiations, but it looks like a big number, $100 million, nice round number, nine digits, but like in the salary cap environment we've got, it's going to turn out to be like 14 or 15% of the cap over the life of the contract, which, as you mentioned, doesn't even cover his prime. It's like the run-up to his prime. His age 26 season will be his final year on this extension. And the bet you're making, if you're the Bulls, is that what we saw in what some of our more cynical internet basketball watching friends might call Mickey Mouse March, what you see where the time of the year where like some teams are tanking and some teams are not really putting out that there's a lot of injuries, not a lot of the old college try happening. And that's when Josh Giddey goes and averages like 21, 10 and 8 on 620 true shooting. And you're like, huh, well, you know, so maybe it's how real is that? The bet that the Bulls are making is the strides he showed with his jump shot, the strides he showed when they put the ball in his hands and let him run the up-tempo offense after the Zach LaVine trade, that stuff's real. And that he can be the engine of an offense that gets above like just like the muck and the mire. The Bulls scored just under 118 points per 100 possessions after the LaVine trade when Giddey was on the floor. So like after Zach goes out and LaVine goes Josh Giddey goes to the top of the pecking order, they're about 118 points per 100 possessions. That's like a top five offense over the course of the full season if that translates. So the idea is he continues his growth there. That offense is the sort of is going to be sticky, is going to maintain. You're going to be able to build an offense around him, around Kobe White. You've got Matas Buzelis growing. You've got Noah Esenge, their first round pick this year. And you've got like a young core to build around moving forward. I think obviously big questions on the defensive end. Giddey, not an elite defender by any stretch of the imagination. Part of the reason that he was on the way out in OKC. A lot of questions about how real his shooting is going to have to be for the league to buy it. If we remember back to the play-in game, the Heat dismantled the Bulls by guarding him with Bam Adebayo. So stick a center on Josh Giddey and let him shoot is still a game plan that he's going to have to prove he can take advantage of. But to this point, they made the trade. They didn't get any other picks back. You kind of knew at that point they were pot committed to getting something done with Josh Giddey. To get it done at $25 million a year, 14, 15% of the cap, not something that's going to prevent them from having massive cap space next summer and moving forward, seems like a decent bit of business all the way around. Whether it gets Chicago out of that like 9-10 band of the play-in picture, I don't know. Maybe with the way the East is going, it will. But if nothing else, to bet on a young player continuing to get better after he showed you some improvement last season seems like a worthwhile bet.
I mean, I feel like the he can't shoot reputation is overblown. He shot 37.8% on threes, and he made over 100 three-pointers last year. So it's not just on low volume. He was actually pretty efficient, above average three-point shooting. Now, a lot of those are wide open. I'm sure if you looked at the data, and I don't have it handy right here, but that he had a lot of open threes. The average distance of the closest defender is probably sizable for Josh Giddey. They're going under on those screens and begging him to shoot, because once he gets downhill and is able to spray the floor, I feel like he is a lot more impactful and teams are giving him that shot. But as we've seen with many players over the years, he can develop that three-point shot and become a more lethal guy with the ball in his hands. He's already an elite passer. So Josh Giddey, he's back with the Bulls. And also Brooklyn Nets got some news with Mr. Cam Thomas that he is taking and accepting the qualifying offer, which means that he's going to be making $6 million and becoming an unrestricted free agent at the end of the season, which is a big gamble for Mr. Cam Thomas, who has over the years been buried on the bench. Even though he scores 40 points in a night, the coaches have not trusted him to be the go-to guy on the team. And the front office obviously was not willing to go with a big contract here with Cam Thomas. And he's saying, I'm betting on myself. Unrestricted free agency, no trade clause. I'm going to basically be able to dictate what I'm going to do this season, but I'm only going to make $6 million, and I'm going to try to get that big contract this year. That's putting a lot of eggs in the basket of the coach, right? Like, you're basically demanding that you're going to do right by me and allow me to get more money by, you know, what he does. He gets buckets, right? So Jordy Fernandez, the fact that he is going to have the keys to his playing time and all of the opportunities that Cam Thomas is going to have to deliver on this QO and be able to prove that he's worth $15, $20 million a year, that's a big gamble, man. So the over-under is at 16.7, according to Fred Katz's Athletic article and the poll that he did, the survey. We took the under, and he decided, yeah, I'm not getting the deals that I want. I'm going to take the way under and go $6 million on the qualifying offer. So, Dan, how do you see this playing out?
Well, I think for Cam Thomas, even the offers that were reportedly available to him, you know, so Shams at ESPN had reported that the Thomas's representatives ultimately declined Brooklyn's two offers that were on the table. One was 2 years, $30 million. So still would have been below the number that we, you know, still would have been the under there. And because that had a team option for the second season.
It's basically a one-year deal. Yeah,
basically a one-year deal. And he wouldn't have had any control over the proceedings. And then the second option was a one-year deal, $9.5 million incentive laden that could get, you know, get up to $11 million, but also would have meant that he didn't have a no trade clause. He had no control over the proceedings. So either one of those offers would have come in at the under on the average annual value and would have left him really open to being traded by the Nets at whatever point they wanted to. Taking the 1 year, $6 million offer, like, it pays him less. It also might allow him a little bit more control, because it's harder to make him matching salary in a deal at $6 million than it would at 15 or at 11, right? So the idea, and also gives him, gets him out a year sooner. Next summer, there's projected to be an awful lot more teams that have significant salary cap space. I think your point is right. I mean, like the Nets don't, if you're no longer invested in the long-term relationship with Cam Thomas, then yeah, what reason do you have to say, like, we got to put him out on the floor and have, especially they just drafted five guys who are all playmakers that need the ball in their hands, right? So like, what's the investment in, we need to maximize what Cam Thomas can be? It's a gamble, but I mean, Cam Thomas has shown himself to be nothing if not willing, eminently confident in his own abilities. So the idea of him betting on himself makes some sense here. I think it will be very interesting to see if that lends itself to the other two restricted free agents making similar decisions with their qualifying offers.
Yeah, it's also going to be playing with Michael Porter Jr., who also wants the ball in his hands.
He's got some takes. I don't know if you've been paying attention, but Michael Porter Jr. entering into the New York media sphere with a lot of opinions that he wants to get off of his chest could wind up being awfully entertaining and maybe not necessarily in the way that Sean Marks would like.
This is going to be a weird Brooklyn Nets season, man.
Dude.
It's going to be really weird.
Yeah.
Really weird. All right. That's going to do it for us here on The Big Number this week. I want to give a shout out to Stone for popping in and producing this week's episode. Thanks to all the producers behind the scenes for making the show a reality. And reminder, Yahoo Sports Network, check it out on your FAST channel. And make sure you check out also yahoosports.tv to catch us 24/7, our new network that we're launching this off-season/summer/fall. Go check it out. Go subscribe to The Big Number on YouTube and wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thanks again for everyone watching, and go tell your friends about it. Training camp is right around the corner.
A couple weeks away.
Hey, Andre Iguodala, if you do, I want a little sleeve. I want a little a little token. I don't know what it would be from the Naismith Hall of Fame if you do get in, because I feel like we're doing some good work to campaign for Andre Iguodala's Hall of Fame candidacy. Knowing Andre Iguodala, he's going to be like, he's no.
You don't think so? You don't think he's going to shout us out from the stage for?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. He is not one
to dream
to give props to the media too much. But I love his game. I love his impact.
We're on his side. So yeah, he can have whatever feelings about us that he wants, but we're in his corner. We'd love to see you in the orange jacket.
That's right.
If they change the color to make it something a little bit more appealing, we'd like to see you in that jacket as well. But we're on Team Andre in this one.
Green jacket, yellow jacket, orange jacket. All right, we're gonna go out on that one. Dan, thanks so much, buddy. We'll talk next week.